From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Soviet Union has granted independence to the Baltics. Historian Walter Clemens Jr. plans on nominating the Baltics for a Nobel Peace Prize. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Clemens. He's written a new book called Baltic Independence and Soviet Empire. The Baltic independence movement has been called the Singing Revolution. We meet two people who played a small part in that revolution, Arnold Karklis and Vid Mednis of the Latvian-American rock band Quags. And there's a new series of American roots music. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a recording in the series from singer Jimmy Dale Gilmore, a singer Ken can't get out of his head. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today called on Congress to postpone consideration of a request by the Israeli government for $10 billion in housing loan guarantees. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Speaking today, even before the Israeli government officially made the request for the loan guarantees, Mr. Bush said Congress should wait 120 days before acting on the issue, saying that a delay is necessary to give peace a chance. Mr. Bush said a debate on Israeli aid would be counterproductive to the peace conference his administration is trying to arrange for next month.
Let's not blow it by having an acrimonious debate that's going to be read not just in the States, but around the world is one way or another. We don't need it.
The Israeli government has rejected past U.S. attempts to delay the loan guarantee request, saying the issue should not be linked to the peace process. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A federal grand jury has indicted a former top official of the CIA on charges related to the Iran-Contra scandal. Claire George, once the third highest official at the Central Intelligence Agency, is charged with perjury, making false statements, and obstructing investigations into the Iran-Contra case. The 10-count indictment charges George with lying to Congress about his agency's involvement in the affair. The indictment was requested by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh, who's been investigating the scandal since 1986. The investigation focuses on a Reagan administration plan to sell arms to Iran, then use the proceeds to arm the Contra rebels in Nicaragua in violation of a congressional ban. The Yugoslav prime minister has strongly criticized the Federal Army for exceeding its role as the peacekeeping force in central Croatia. Pierre Vickery reports the prime minister appealed to the European community to intensify its efforts to stop the fighting.
Speaking in Belgrade on the eve of the peace conference in The Hague, Ante Marković said the European community must continue its efforts to bring peace to Yugoslavia. If it proved impossible to stop the fighting, the international community would have to consider further measures, including the possible deployment of an armed peacekeeping force. For the first time, the Prime Minister publicly criticized the Yugoslav army, accusing military units in Croatia of having used excessive force. He expressed optimism that the war could be stopped and that a political compromise would be found which would guarantee full local autonomy for all communities within existing internal Yugoslav borders. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Stock prices barely changed again today on Wall Street after a mixed session as traders studied the latest government figures on unemployment. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 3,011.63. Declines edged advances in active trading. This is NPR. Investigators in Hamlet, North Carolina, said today that locked or obstructed exits contributed to the death toll in Tuesday's fire at a chicken processing plant. 25 people were killed in the fire, most from smoke inhalation. A state insurance investigator said that two of the plant's doors couldn't be used. He said the fire doors didn't meet national safety standards and the building had only one fire extinguisher. The report is being sent on to the district attorney for a criminal investigation. Federal Judge Robert Collins of New Orleans has been sentenced to 6 years and 10 months in prison. Jim Engster reports.
Judge Collins was convicted of taking a $100,000 bribe in exchange for a lenient sentence for a drug smuggler. Co-defendant John Ross received a sentence of 7 years and 4 months. Prosecutors say Ross was the middleman in a bribery conspiracy to get a reduced sentence for Gary Young. They contend Ross accepted the bribe from Young and gave part of the money to Collins. At the time, Young was cooperating secretly with federal investigators who supplied him with marked bills and taped conversations about the bribes. Sentencing Judge Julian Young ordered Collins to stay away from the federal courthouse, where the judge has continued to show up for work since his July conviction, even though no cases have been assigned to Collins. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Inkster in Baton Rouge.
One of the nation's largest defense contractors pleaded guilty to criminal charges in the Pentagon procurement scandal today. Unisys, the successor to the Sperry Corporation, admitted to charges ranging from bribing government officials to lying about weapons programs. The company agreed to pay a record $190 million in fines and penalties. Despite the guilty plea, the government will allow Unisys to continue doing business with the Pentagon. The company will also be allowed to spread the payments on its fine over a period of at least 6 years, based in part on future profits. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Soviet Union's highest legislature voted itself out of existence and dissolved the Soviet Union as we know it. A newly created state council has granted independence to the Baltics. My guest, Walter Clemens Jr., says the Baltic independence movement has provided the model of a nonviolent resistance movement, a model that can be emulated inside and outside the Soviet Union. Clemens is the author of the new book, Baltic Independence and Russian Empire. He's a professor of political science at Boston University and is affiliated with the Harvard Center for Science and International Affairs. I spoke to him earlier today and asked what his emotional reaction is to the Baltics' new independence.
That is a great moment for them and in some way for me. My most intense emotional involvement happened about a year ago in Estonia, when I saw the Congress of the Estonian people gather for the first time and assert the country's sovereignty and its right to do its own thing. I was there in a conference hall where people were, everyone around me was weeping and singing and so on. And it was a very intense moment.
You plan to nominate the Baltics for a Nobel Peace Prize. What will your recommendation say, do you think?
Well, the basic argument is that their model of nonviolent resistance is one that has worked for them and I think shows a road that other peoples could follow, should follow. The way that they went about it was partly using the slogan of perestroika and glasnost. They used glasnost to expose some of the Soviet brutality of the past, perestroika to organize popular fronts and other social organizations that plugged for national self-determination. They responded to Soviet violence with nonviolence. They refused to be provoked. When I was in Estonia about a year ago, I was with people who were associated with the Popular Front there. They made a point not to get caught up in the very large assemblies of Russian settlers there that were organized by large Soviet factories in Estonia because they were afraid there might be some kind of a provocation and bloodshed that could be used against them.
You've described the Baltic independence movement as the singing revolution. Is that your phrase or is that something that they've called themselves?
It's one that they have used to describe their own movement. And it turns out that over 100 years ago, the Balts began to organize song festivals in local parish churches. And once railroads began to cross across the Baltic and link these different parish churches, they came together to hold festivals, competitions, in which people would sing these old songs, went back hundreds, maybe 1,000 years, some of them. And from that, they began to feel themselves a people. And there's a tremendous moral force when people come together and sing. We see some of that in festivals in this country, but the scale of the song fests in the Baltic is out of all proportion to anything that I've ever heard of in the States. They sometimes get almost 500,000 people in one place for days singing, you know, asserting that we are a group, we have a right to live our own life, and so on. And it turns out that this has helped them to withstand tanks and armed force of the Soviet Union.
What are the songs that would be sung at the Songfest?
Well, these are mostly older folk songs. up in the Soviet period, let's say from 1945 until recent years, they were usually required to insert a number of songs glorifying Soviet unity. Last year in Estonia was the first time that they were able to have a song festival in which only Estonian songs were used.
What are some of your greatest hopes for the Baltics now that they're independent?
One hope is for the quality of their own lives. They know that in the late 1930s, their living standards were somewhat similar to those in Finland. Now, those of them who go to Finland as guest workers realize that Finnish living standards and in general living standards throughout Scandinavia are vastly superior to theirs. They feel that they've been given an unfair albatross by the Soviet system. That's being removed. Of course, it's going to be very hard for them to reintegrate with the world economy. The quality of what they produce is simply not up to Western standards. Chernobyl and other things have maybe even contaminated some of the food that they may wish to export. So there are a lot of problems ahead for them, but I basically believe that they have the intelligence and the habits of industry and thrift that will help them to radically improve their living standards in the next 5 or 10 years.
But I also hope
that they will become a bridge between East and West, and that whatever good the West does have to offer may be funneled even into Russia and the Ukraine and other parts of the USSR through the Baltic.
On this day when many people are celebrating Baltic independence, there's also some cause for concern. And I'm thinking about the exonerations that Lithuania has been issuing to Nazi war criminals who were condemned by Soviet courts. And apparently Lithuania has already issued about 1,000 certificates of rehabilitation. And, the United States told Lithuania that it expected Lithuania to comply with its own law by excluding war criminals from its program of exoneration. I'm wondering if you could interpret for us what's happening there, why Lithuania has been issuing these exonerations. And if you share the concern of so many people in the United States, particularly Jewish people in the United States, that they're exonerating people who were Nazi sympathizers.
And who worked with the Nazis in
killing Jews.
Well, the reports on this are so far so spotty that I'm afraid to pass any judgment on it. But I think we have to understand that the Balts are very concerned that thousands and thousands of their population disappeared during the 1940s and even later than that, when many of them were shipped off to Siberia. Most of those who were condemned by Soviet courts were condemned for essentially doing nothing or perhaps cooperating with Germans against the Soviet Union. I suspect that a very small number of them were involved in anti-Semitic activities. Now, the Lithuanians may have rushed, I think that they have rushed, to a mass exoneration of those people who were condemned by Soviet courts. But if you know how Soviet courts operate, and if you have seen, as I have, the kind of slips that were sent to families in the 1950s saying, your relative, your father, whatever, was wrongly condemned by a Soviet military tribunal and is rehabilitated posthumously, you begin to sympathize with the people in the Baltics who feel that large numbers of them were wrongly accused. Also, many of them lost their property because of these arrests and condemnations by Soviet courts. So I hope that the Lithuanians make clear that they are not going to exonerate Nazi collaborators, and particularly those who were involved in killing Jews. I suspect that with some period of time that clarification will take place.
Do you see this process of exoneration as being a sign that Lithuania might condone anti-Semitism?
Well, there's certainly a lot of worry among Jews there, among Poles there, among Russians there, and some other minorities, that once the Lithuanians are really in charge, that these other minorities will be persecuted in some way. there is at least one sign going in the completely in the opposite direction, and that is that the Lithuanian has recently signed an agreement with Russia, making it very easy for Russian citizens to become citizens of Lithuania. Earlier, there was a requirement that they had to learn Lithuanian rather quickly, and that they had to live in Lithuania for a certain time period. Those limits have recently been relaxed, I would say, in an almost over-generous way, because I think they're inviting perhaps a flood of Russian immigrants into their own country now.
Are you concerned about ethnic hostilities between Lithuanians and Russians in Lithuania? Russians are a minority in each of the three republics, but let's see, there's a 30% Russian population in two of the three republics. I mean, it's pretty large.
Well, in Lithuania, the number of non-Lithuanians is about 20% of the total. And in recent years, Russians were certainly the target of a lot of defamatory remarks and some discrimination. But I think that now that Lithuania feels free, they can in some way relax and take it easy when before they were uptight. And of course, they had reason to be uptight. Some, not all, but some of those Russians were something like a fifth column working from within. Many of them had privileges and perks that the Lithuanians wanted for themselves. One way to think about these Russians is to imagine the way Algerians felt about Frenchmen in the years before Algerian independence. Once Algeria was independent, then they could look at Frenchmen in a somewhat more relaxed way.
But in the meantime, the Russians have been perceived as the oppressor, as the representatives of the Soviet government.
Yes. In Estonia, in Tallinn, the capital, something like half of the population, maybe more in the capital, is Russian. And many of the street signs have been in Russian. There was a Yuri Gagarin Boulevard, and all kinds of signs of Russian domination. And so if you were a proud people aware that you had a historic past that goes back 1,000, 2,000 years, then all of these signs in the memory of relatives who have been sent off to Siberia and so on, that's all very, very painful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Walter Clemens, Jr. He's the author of the new book, Baltic Independence and Russian Empire. We're going to take a short break, and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Clemens, professor of political science at Boston University. The Baltics became part of the Soviet Empire back in the 1700s, and the only time that they were really independent was in the period between the two world wars. If we look at that period, what kind of governments did they have in the time that they were independent? How did they handle the independence?
Well, in the first place, they had very little experience with self-government. And during that entire period, they were harassed from the one side by the Soviet Union, which had its revolutionary outbursts even in the early 1920s and during most of the 1930s. On the other side, there was Germany shifting toward fascism from the early 1930s. So they were squeezed between two superpowers of that period, both of them totalitarian dictatorships. Now, in addition to that, they had to cope with the depression, world depression, economic depression. And during that period, in the 1930s, the Baltic republics developed very authoritarian regimes. And that's the way they were on the eve of the Soviet takeover. So they have very little history of self-government. Now, on top of that, we have the Soviet model that there's one truth, one way to do things. And that kind of model, I think, is still in the minds of many of the people today, even those who are liberal reformers. They are very intolerant of other viewpoints. I pointed out to them that the New York Times has an op-ed page in which they value having opposed opinions. And I said the Soviet newspaper, Literaturnaya Gazeta, Literary Gazette, is now developing something like that clash of opinions. And some of the Balts I spoke to said, well, we can't afford that kind of clash of opinion. Now, this was a year, two, 3 years ago, before their independence. And it remains to be seen whether, now that they are independent, they will be able to really tolerate a diversity of viewpoint.
Now that the Baltics are independent, how much do you think they'll be working together? I'm wondering what some of the divisions are among the Baltic states.
First of all, they have different languages. Lithuanian and Latvian are fairly close to each other, but Estonian is closer to Finnish. During the 1920s and 30s, they made some attempt at working together, but they didn't pull it off very well. In the last two or three years, however, the popular fronts in each country, in each of the Baltic republics, have come together and formed a Baltic Council. And that Baltic Council meets every month now. Either the prime ministers or another top minister of each of the republics meets. And their efforts at working together have gone rather smoothly in the last few years. You've probably noticed that the foreign ministers were traveling around in Europe and other places working out the details of recognition for the Baltic republics. I would expect that they would work out some kind of a trade deal that would permit free passage of goods across their frontiers. They are even beginning to work out that kind of arrangement with Russia. There are good precedents for this. The peace treaties between Russia and the Baltic republics in 1920 provided for liberalized trade regimes between Russia and the different Baltic republics. And the Balts are attempting to go back to those early treaties from 1920 as a model of how to do things today.
I'm really kind of interested in how the timing of people's books and records and so on relating to the Baltics and to the Soviet Union is being affected by these really sudden changes. Your book is called Baltic Independence and Russian Empire. It was written, of course, before the Soviet Union recognized Baltic independence. How do you think the timing of this is going to affect your book, and how do you feel about your book having been completed before that final chapter could have been written?
Well, I have thought for the last several years that the Balts would achieve independence very shortly, and I tried to write the book with that expectation in mind, but I also wrote it in a way that I put everything into the past tense, rather than into the present or certainly the future tense. Instead of making a flat prediction, the last chapter analyzes dilemmas that face the Balts, the Russians, and the United States on how to cope with the kinds of problems that result. Basically, if you exploit a people like the Balts have been exploited, you know that pretty soon there's going to be an eruption. And so I wrote the book with that eruption in mind.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Walter Clemens is a professor of political science at Boston University and author of the new book, Baltic Independence and Soviet Empire. The late American writer Josephine Herbst was always interested in political dissent, both at home and abroad. She's probably best known for her trilogy of novels about an American family from the turn of the century through the Depression. The books are Pity Is Not Enough, The Executioner Waits, and Rope of Gold. Book critic John Leonard has a review of a new book of Herbst's essays about her life called The Starched Blue Sky of Spain.
The American novelist Josephine Herbst died in 1969 at age 77. Her autobiography, Unfinished. These four essays, on growing up in the Midwest, on bohemian days in Greenwich Village, on left-wing literary life in the 1930s and witch hunts in the 1940s, and on Spain with Hemingway and Despasos during the Civil War, are as much as we'll ever get of that autobiography. They are more than enough. Pages so dense, prose so radiant, intelligence so sensuous, that the starched blue sky of Spain is an amazement. I never read Herp's novels until inspired to do so by Eleanor Langer's splendid biography in 1984. And even then I found them muscle-bound, with too many feelings and secrets, too much history and resentment. From Langer, we know Herbst's marriage broke up as much because of her lesbian affair with a painter as it did because of her husband's philandering and alcoholism. We also know she never joined the Communist Party. And we know she was fired from her government job in World War II because her old friend, Catherine Ann Porter, secretly informed against her. But none of this matters in her memoir. It's as if Herbst, at the end, had rubbed so hard on the warts of her venturesome life that they gleamed like jewels. We meet the small child, seeing an ocean for the first time. The young girl, pining like one of Chekhov's sisters for the Moscows of New York and Paris. The young adult in Manhattan, trafficking with Ford Maddox Ford, William Carlos Williams, and Nathaniel West, playing poker with Alan Tate and Hart Crane. The committed writer, in Germany and Russia, ever alert to the odd detail. The war correspondent in Spain, to which she says, men had been summoned, as it were, from the shadow of a cellar. The whistle that the very air gives to every child at birth had been stopped with dirt. Now they had cleaned the whistle. And whether for a little while or for years they might be allowed to make the music of the living didn't perhaps matter so much as the fact of now. The saving grace was to use the now as if it were literally the forever. About the great migration of writers from the Midwest to New York and Europe, she can be ironic. Though we had put distance between ourselves and our origins, and now, as though through a telescope, imagined we might view the planets that had presided at our birth, we bore the stigmata of an early upbringing. It would take years to value the long shadows on the grass, the smell of homemade bread, the hum of the telegraph wires in the winds of an empty prairie. But she can't forget how exciting it was to be an expatriate, young and brilliant. A sense of fatalism fed the anarchistic heart, she says, but fatalism does not always degrade. It may inspire elation. If we had abandoned the safe lives our parents had fancied so valuable, we seem to have gained an insight into the creative fissures of the world. The fires and smoke steamed up from volcanoes. A young writer might hang a death mask of Nietzsche on the wall, remembering a young Russian poet in mittens and overcoat who had scribbled away beneath his freezing death mask of Pushkin. Herbst quotes Rilke, too. Choose to be changed, with the flame be enraptured. And she was. To get to Russia, she sold a first edition of Joyce's Ulysses. I wish I'd gone with her.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Josephine Herbst's new book, Starched Blue Sky of Spain. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet two members of a Latvian-American rock band who are proud to have played a small part in Latvia's independence movement. They play protest songs, anthems of independence, and just plain pop. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new release in a new series of American roots music by singer Jimmy Dale Gilmore. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush's request to Congress to delay for 120 days consideration of Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees has been angrily rejected in Jerusalem. Patricia Golan reports that Israeli officials believe that the Bush administration is trying to exploit the plight of Soviet Jewish immigrants in order to gain concessions from Israel in Middle Eastern peace talks.
The request is thought to be the most critical the Israeli government has ever made. The guarantees would allow Israel to raise the money from commercial banks to help in the enormous cost of absorbing Soviet immigrants. Israeli officials are angry and disappointed over President Bush's request for a delay. It's clear, they say, that Arab pressures have borne fruit. Without the guarantees, it is extremely doubtful Israel can raise the money itself. Officials fear the loan guarantees will be used as a lever to force Israel to halt Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, which this government has no intention of doing. Nevertheless, officials in Jerusalem say they believe Congress will approve the guarantees and will agree with Israel that it is unjust to mix political considerations with humanitarian needs. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The Soviet Union has granted independence to the Baltic republics after more than 50 years of Kremlin rule. This move by the State Council in Moscow comes 51 years after Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia were absorbed by the Soviet Union under an agreement with Nazi Germany, and comes after a two-year Baltic campaign to break away from the Soviet state. In a report to be submitted tomorrow, UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar suggests that Iraq be able to sell almost $1 billion more in oil than was authorized by the UN Security Council in a resolution last month. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The Secretary General's lengthy report must still be approved by the Security Council next week, but it asks the Council to consider raising the present $1.6 billion total to pay for a shortfall in food supplies. According to the report, Iraq's basic supplies have dropped dramatically since the Gulf War, and it says the present situation is critical, with the population in danger of full-scale famine. If the report is approved, it would give Iraq some limited control over its own economy, allowing Baghdad to take charge of its oil sales and food distribution. But the strict monitoring procedure may be rejected by Iraq as a violation of its sovereignty. And a Western diplomat said the Council may insist on sticking to the amounts specified in the current resolution. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 3 points to close at 3,011.63 on volume of 166 million shares. This is NPR News. German officials say that six NATO countries, including the United States, have agreed to update a 1959 agreement that gives special rights to NATO troops. It's believed that German officials want to gain greater control on where and when NATO military exercises can take place. After 2 days of talks, the seven countries said that there is also a continued need to keep NATO troops stationed in Germany. About 320,000 foreign troops were based in Germany at the start of the year. Investigators in Hamlet, North Carolina, have concluded that blocked fire doors contributed to some of the 25 deaths in a fire this week at the Imperial Foods chicken processing plant. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
An investigation by the North Carolina Department of Insurance found that two of the fire exits at the plant couldn't be opened because they were blocked or locked. A report by the department also says the plant did not meet national safety standards. There was no automatic sprinkler system, no evacuation plan, and only one fire extinguisher. The report says 12 of the 25 victims tried to escape through a plant door but found it locked then tried to escape through a loading dock but found it blocked. The report has been turned over to the local district attorney, who may file criminal charges against the owners of Imperial Foods. A company official insisted Tuesday that, in his words, plenty of doors were open, but the company has refused to comment since then. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
A federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. has returned a 10-count indictment against Claire George, once the third highest CIA official. He is accused of lying to Congress about the CIA role in the Iran-Contra scandal. George faces charges of perjury, making false statements, and obstruction of investigations. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Baltic independence movement has been called the singing revolution, but it's not just traditional music that has helped keep the culture and independent spirit alive. Rock and roll has played a part, too. My guests are two members of the Latvian-American rock group The Quags. Arnold Karklis and Vid Mednis both sing and play guitar. Though you've probably never heard of The Quags, they've had a cult following in Latvia for the past few years. In 1989 and 1990, the band toured Latvia and discovered that tapes of their Latvian rock and roll had been circulating around the country through underground channels. The Quags' music combines rock and roll, protest songs, and nationalist anthems. The Quags have a new album called One of Us. This song, Under Two Flags, weaves in a couple of Latvian nationalist songs and includes sound bites from the news coverage of the Soviet crackdown in the Baltics last January.
Soviet troops made their move for Lithuania's TV and radio station in the early hours of the morning, rolling tanks up to the doorstep, flooding the building with searchlights, and opening fire on some of those who tried to block their way.
Tanks crushed cars like flimsy toys. We saw one driver dead, trapped inside.
At least 13 people were killed in the attack, most from gunshot wounds. A man and a woman were reportedly crushed to death by oncoming tanks. When ambulances finished rushing through the capital city's darkened streets, more than 140 wounded filled the hospital wards.
Soldiers used nightsticks, smoke bombs, and at last, live ammunition.
Under two flags.
So what are some of the things that are going through your mind now that the Soviet Union has recognized Baltic independence? Vid, can we start with you?
Yes. Recently, I've given a lot of thought to the stories that my parents have told me about when they left. My mother, for example, left Latvia at the age of 9, spent 5 years in Germany in displaced persons camps, at which time, I think it was 1949, that they finally ended up in the United States. And the struggles that they went through coming here and speaking not so much English, just enough to get by, and knowing all the time that cultivating the heritage, the Latvian heritage, would be very, very important, and that's indeed what they gave to my generation. They raised us as Latvians. We went to the proverbial Latvian Sunday school and learned everything from history to art, literature, all the whole gamut of subjects for Latvian. And independence is wonderful. We the Quags have done a lot in the last few years to try to advocate the cause of Baltic freedom, and that's how that CD landed on your desk. And it is actually somewhat ironic that at the time of the CD release, we're able to see the changes that fall apart of the Soviet Union.
In what ways do you think Latvian traditional music has influenced the brand of rock and pop that you're playing now?
We were raised, of course, on Latvian cultural music. We learned to play Latvian instruments, the kuokla. And for myself, we participated in quite a few mini ensembles. My sisters and I used to perform at Latvian events. And we sang in the car all the time with mom and dad. That was one of the most effective means for them to convey what we are. And we sang and heard lots of music and were involved in that. That was the spark, I think, that got me interested in music period.
Vid, you brought a traditional Latvian instrument with you, one of the ones that you actually play on the new record. What's it called? It's basically like a laptop zither-like instrument.
Indeed.
What's it called? And maybe you could play a little bit of it.
The instrument is called a kuokla, and members of our family were actively involved in trying to keep this instrument and the playing in an ensemble format of this kuokla alive. This is another form of the music that our parents raised us on. We sang folk songs and played this instrument, performed quite often.
We give a listen to how this sounds in a more rock setting, because you also play this instrument on your new record.
Yes, the instrument is used in a song called City Got a New Name, it's in the background, but it's there, and we do have a tendency to borrow from our culture and heritage in our rock music.
Let's give it a listen. This is the Quags. That City Got a New Name from the Quags' new CD, One of Us. We'll talk more with band members Arnold Karklis and Vid Medness after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Two members of the Latvian-American rock band, The Quags, are my guests. I really ought to ask you what the name means. Does that have a Latvian significance or an American significance that I'm missing?
It's really a convenient translation of the name of the band in Latvian, Akacis. Akacis is a area of the swamp. You might call it a bottomless pit or a hole in the bog somewhere. And translation obviously would be a quagmire, and we simply shortened the word and pluralized it and made it quags.
You know, the historian Walter Clemens Jr. has called the independence movements in the Baltics the singing revolution because traditional song played such an important part of it. You've been to Latvia, you know, playing with your bands, and I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of the roles that both traditional music and rock music have played in the independence movements in the Baltics.
As far as rock music goes, the group Pērkons hosted us in 1989.
Is this a rock band?
It's a rock band in Latvia. And they were one of the first bands to break out of the doldrum of what music was there in the beginning of the 80s. And they were, I guess, perhaps one of the more popular underground bands at the time. In the mid-80s, they put on a grandiose concert that ended up in some sort of how could I call it, near rioting on the train on the way home. The young people that attended the concert got out of hand, and that was pretty much the end of Pērkons playing for quite a few years until we came back in 1989. Rock music has a definite effect on the way it helped the young people there convey the way they felt about the stagnation and the way they were treated by the communist regime.
Can one of you tell us a story of what it was like to be on stage at a concert that was a part of the independence movement during one of your Latvia performances?
Well, we closed, this is our first tour of Latvia, we closed our concert with a drawn-out rock and roll version of a folk song called Kad Pārnāks Bāliliņ, which means, "When will you come home, brother?" And we sort of turned it into an anti-war song. It pretty much is an anti-war song. It laments the fact that the Bāliliņ has gone far away to fight a war for some imperial power or even a local lord or some, for some reason he's away at war. And part of why we did that song in 1989 was really to sort of test our own courage and activism at the time, and it really did get a good response. And at one concert at all concerts, in fact, there were militiamen sort of keeping the peace, so to speak, and every now and then you'd see an army officer or two, and you never knew, you know. One ridiculous instance, the public was not allowed near the stage on the track, so to speak. They were up in the stands, a good 100 yards away from us. And we watched this incredible farce, a charade of teenagers jumping at various parts of the stadium, running around all over the track, you know, which was totally empty, and these uniformed militia guys running after them and occasionally grabbing them by the hair and, you know, either escorting them out of the place or making them go back up. So there already was this sort of defiance, cat and mouse game going on that we got to see quite a lot of.
Was it acceptable under Soviet rule to play rock music and to record rock music? What kind of controls were there?
Absolutely not. There were controls in terms of to be given the privilege to perform in public. You had to submit all of your material, all the music, all the lyrics, text, everything, to terrification committees, I think they were called. And anyone that was remotely going towards, you know, some sort of rock styles were usually condemned right from the get-go. Said, forget it, you know, this really has no place.
Were you ever arrested or threatened during a performance tour?
No, by then things had, you know, Gorbachev had really done quite a bit by then, and the independence movements had really caught fire by that time. So the circle of people that we moved around in were totally supportive of independence, and we never came upon any kind of confrontational situation with authorities or that type of thing, no.
I got to ask you, when you were both growing up, did you ever Americanize your names? I mean, Arnold, your last name has an S in it, so it's spelled Arnold's,
yeah.
Your first name.
Arnolds Karklis.
And Vid, your full first name is Vidvus.
Yeah, my first name is Vidvus, and indeed I do confess there were times in high school at the beginning of, I think we called it homeroom back then, the
yes.
Roll call, there would be a long pause and the teacher would simply be looking around and I would raise my hand sheepishly and say, that's me and you can call me whatever you like. It could be Vid or it could be Jake. I used my middle name, which is Jakobs, Jacob. And a lot of people found it easier to call me Jake throughout high school, and I think that kind of caught on. I'm not particularly proud of that, and in my professional life, I don't do that. There's no need to do that. But yeah, it was a source of distress as a child.
And Arnold, did people think that the S on the end of your first name was a typo?
In terms of you know, birth certificates and social security numbers and so on, I really am Arnold. But I as well tried to switch for reasons not having to do with Latvian, you know, the fact that my name Arnold really has more to do with the fact that kids were watching Green Acres at the time and Arnold was a pig, you know. That's why I tried to change my name to my middle name of Martin, but that's, you know, irrelevant to the ethnic issue.
One last question on the very most kind of selfish level. Since several of the songs on the new album are a call for independence, is the timing of your record a bad thing or a good thing for you? This is just on the most kind of superficial, selfish level.
We have always worked on, I think, two levels. We wanted to help Latvia as far as publicizing the independence movement there, the freedom movement. The songs have done more than their share for that, I think. Independence was sung in protests and demonstrations this year all over, as far as Australia. On the other level, our music is itself, and we've been pursuing professional careers as musicians here in America. So we're covered in either way, but we don't feel compelled to look at it that way either.
Yeah, in many ways, those two identities are inextricable from each other. But right now, it's a great feeling to have that burden lifted off your shoulders, that you don't have to go around. Self-righteously, indignantly saying, Soviets, get out. Now we can start working on our own careers and base that towards building a better future for all Latvians.
It was our way of being part of the movement.
Arnold Karklis and Vid Mednis are members of the Latvian-American rock band Quags. They're based in Philadelphia. Their new CD is One of Us. This is one of the band's original tunes. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are leading the program with a story on the president's decision to ask Congress to delay aid to Israel, presumably in part at least, to put pressure on Israel to join and enthusiastically support the peace process. We have an interview this evening with Vytautas Landsbergis, the president of Lithuania. We have a feature piece from the Soviet Union also on what children think about what's been happening. Also, teachers goofing off on the job and songs from cowboy movies.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After hearing about the role of music in the Baltic independence movement, we have some American roots music. Elektra Records' new American Explorers series features 6 records by performers who draw on different regional strains within American popular music. One of these albums is Jimmy Dale Gilmore's After a While. Ken Tucker has a review.
Tonight, I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight, I think I'm gonna look around for something I couldn't see when this world was more real to me. Tonight, I think I'm gonna go downtown.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore has one of those blithely nasal, blissfully off-key voices that you either find redolent of sincerity and conviction or just a silly annoyance. It's a measure of my respect for Gilmore's work that I keep playing his new album, After a While, over and over, and I still haven't decided where I stand on the matter of his singing. That's mostly because I'm so intrigued by his songwriting that I'm willing to give his singing the benefit of the doubt.
When he first knew his beauty, he brought no flowers and she never asked him why. Although she shared his love of duty, he chased the wind in search of glory. She went beside him till he tried to reach the sky. Then she would wait to hear his story, and love was all that stayed between sister and a brother.
Gilmore comes from Lubbock, Texas, an area of the country conducive to the sort of unclassifiable singer-songwriter art that Gilmore practices. Butch Hancock, Townes Van Zandt, and Nancy Griffith are among the original oddballs who've emerged from there. But in many ways, Jimmie Dale Gilmore is Lubbock's most earnest oddball, a musician who combines country, folk, early rock and roll, and the blues, and applies a literary sensibility to his tales of heartbreak and regret.
I don't think I remember when we met. I don't think I feel any reason to forget. The world that's driven you to me and made my story of you. The time I spent a-telling you that I really love you, do you know? The place I've made for you. And do you know the back streets I've gone through?
At his best, Gilmore transcends a shameless sentimentality, and his wobbly tenor takes on a surging strength. Listening to this music, it's easy to understand why Gilmore isn't a star. What radio format is going to play all over the map stuff like this? Still, it's hard not to get caught up in Jimmie Dale Gilmore's conflicting emotions.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is no mystery. Things aren't what they seem. In your most secret sorrow, in your most secret dream, you shelter your history from love and from life, stealing what's already yours like dark. From the night, dark from the night. Don't be a stranger to your heart. Oh no, don't be a stranger to your heart.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Confirmation hearings will soon begin for Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. On the next Fresh Air, New York Times columnist and former Supreme Court reporter Anthony Lewis gives us his thoughts on the nomination. And we discuss his new book about one of the most important First Amendment decisions in Supreme Court history. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.